WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. Maya Angelou has documented her remarkable life in five volumes of autobiography. I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings describes her childhood in Stamps, Arkansas. Angelou was raped by her mother's boyfriend when she was 7 and a half. After that, she withdrew and didn't speak for years. Angelou became an unmarried mother at 16. She traveled the country with her son and earned a living as a waitress, prostitute, madam, singer, actress, and writer. In the 1960s, she was active in the civil rights movement. She married an African independence leader, and she and her son went to live in Africa, where she wrote, "We were black Americans in West Africa, where for the first time in our lives, the color of our skin was accepted as correct and normal." Angelou now lives in North Carolina, where she's a professor of American Studies at Wake Forest University. She has recently published a collection of poems titled, "We Shall Not Be Moved." I asked her to read one of her new poems.
Workers' Song. Big ships shudder down to the sea because of me. Railroads run on a twinness track cause of my back. Whopper, 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 whopper. Cars stretch to a super length cause of my strength. Planes fly high over seas and lands cause of my hands. Whopper. Whopper, whopper, whopper. I wake, start the factory humming. I work late, keep the whole world running. And I got something, something coming, coming. Whopper, 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 whopper.
That's wonderful. What's the influence of music in your poetry?
Oh.
Because I'm watching you, and our audience can't watch you, but you were moving to that poem.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, poetry originally was always accompanied by music. In Africa, in Greece, Sappho, the shreds of her poems, which represent some of the first poems in the West, were always accompanied by lyres or lutes. In Asia, poetry is accompanied by some instrument, depending upon what country, what culture. So I think that the poetry of the 19th century, which has influenced me most, of course, the Paul Laurence Dunbar and James Weldon Johnson poetry, and the poetry of Edgar Allan Poe, were always musical. I heard the music.
And you find the music, I guess, even in the words. I'm thinking of the
yes.
way, what appears to be the importance of rhyming in your poetry, and I think it's we don't often find that anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, rhyming seems to be passé,
yeah.
but not for you.
No, I still love it. I do a lot of poetry, which is free form, but there is rhythm even in the free form poetry, just not rhyme necessarily.
Do you ever accompany yourself with an instrument as you speak your poetry?
No, I can hear them, though. I hear them just somewhere over my right ear. I can hear drums, and sometimes I hear the tambourine, and I can hear the saxophone. I always hear saxophone.
Do you know why?
No, I think the alto sax and the cello are the two instruments for me which sound like the human voice, and maybe which sound like my grandmother's voice, which was the most beautiful voice I'd ever heard when I was a child. And so that's the voice, that's the melody, rather that's the instrumentation I hear.
I've heard critics say, and I've read what critics have written about your prose, and they comment on the poetry within the prose, which makes me wonder whether you aren't a poet first before you are a prose writer.
You know, I don't know. I really don't. I was asked what form, what writing form I admire most. And I admire poetry when I'm writing it. And I admire prose when I'm writing it. But each is the most difficult thing to do. Nathaniel Hawthorne said, easy reading is damned hard writing. Mm-hmm. And he's just on the money. It's always difficult. But each form is also gratifying when you just come as close as you can to saying what you mean to say and saying it with eloquence mm-hmm. and brevity. Then one is over the moon, as the English say.
Is there a mood or a something in your life that makes you want to write poetry as opposed to prose? And I know this particular book is your first book of poetry in a number of years.
That's true. I don't know what happens which makes me sit down and say it's poetry time. I just don't know, but I know I can only write poetry then. And that's all I want to do. I might take one idea and work with it for a month and find the thing change in my hands. You know, I cook. That's my hobby. And it's as if I start with a big, wonderful mound of dough, which I am kneading, and suddenly that dough turns into a tomato. You understand? I mean, it's so surprising to me that the work has its own energy and its own intent, and it's a rebellious mind. So finally, I have to, as a respecter of the form, I must say, well, this, I started to make a loaf of bread. This has turned into a tomato. So I guess I'll make some sliced tomato and, you know, salad and basil or something. But you haven't asked for this poem, but there's a little piece which is really epigrammatic. I started writing about bigotry and the bigotry in the women's movement, as well as the bigotry in among men that I see from particularly white men. Mm-hmm. And I wrote about, 7 or 8 pages. And it kept getting smaller and smaller and getting wry instead of being, you know, angry and telling. And it ended up being these 4 little lines. The man who is a bigot is the worst thing God has got. Except his match, his woman, who really is Ms. Bigot. I thought, is that, I mean, have I reduced it? it just wouldn't go any further.
Well, is poetry then a matter or a process of reduction, of peeling away words, peeling away images until you get to, as you say, this tomato?
Yes. Everything is. Every art form, I believe, is the art of peeling away. It is the art of saying yes. Yes, I can take this away. Yes, I can take this away. I mean, Machiavelli had such a coarse, rather cruel way of dealing with that idea, but that was even so with his Machiavellian intent, that you continue to peel away until you have just the nub of the thing. And that's true with Michelangelo. I mean, he could see a piece of marble and say, I see the Pietà in there. That's amazing.
So it's a matter of discovering the Pietà within the stone.
That's right.
And for you then, it's discovering the poem, I guess, within all the words and the images.
Yes.
Well, I'd love to have you read another poem. This is called Old Folks Laugh.
They have spent their content of simpering, holding their lips this and that way, winding the lines between their brows. Old folks allow their bellies to jiggle like slow tambourines. The hollers rise up and spill over any way they want. When old folks laugh, they free the world. They turn slowly, slyly knowing the best and worst of remembering. Saliva glistens in the corners of their mouths. Their heads wobble on brittle necks, but their laps are filled with memories. When old folks laugh, they consider the promise of dear, painless death and generously forgive life for happening to them.
What I love about that poem is the idea of a kind of body as a landscape. Yeah. And I think as we get older, we watch our own bodies change. You're pointing to yourself. The landscape that's been so familiar to us begins to shift and change and become, in certain ways, unfamiliar and
very,
then new.
Very, very new. I saw a photograph of myself yesterday in a national newspaper on the cover, a huge photograph. And the photograph looked like my grandmother. I don't mean I resemble my grandmother. I mean the photograph looked like her. And I thought, my Lord. I closed my eyes and went, you know, to sleep one night. Or else I went in the kitchen to make an omelet. I picked up the phone to talk to my friend. And I got old. When next I looked at myself. It's amazing.
Well, is it also a scary kind of process, too?
Yes, it is. And it's wonderful at the same time. I mean, I'm not talking about wonderful as opposed to the obvious alternative, which is whatever it is, mm-hmm. and which I will face along with everyone else. But it's wonderful, full of wonder. I'm amazed at what I know. I'm amazed at what I don't know. I can't believe I can be so slow to learn. And yet I'm amazed at the repository of information which I have accumulated over these 60-odd years.
Is that how many years
it's been? Yes, 62.
Well, do you think about the rest of your life? I mean, are you at the point in your life where you say, I have less time to live than I've had up until this point?
Well, I always thought I had less time. I thought early on that I was going to die at 28. I thought I was going to be a very successful real estate broker who had her own attaché case. Thank you. And and I would die at 28 having amassed quite a nice portfolio and maybe two or even three houses.
Why 28?
I don't know. But I always expected to die early. So this is full of wonder to be 62 and to still look okay, you know, and feel good. The bones will not let you forget. I mean, there is that. But to still be laughing most, you know, laughing as much as I cry, which is really the balance one wants in one's life, I think I want.
My guest is writer Maya Angelou. She has a new book of poetry titled I Shall Not Be Moved. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Maya Angelou is my guest. She has a brand new book of poetry called I Shall Not Be Moved, and it's just been published by, and I'm twisting the book
by
to...
By Random House.
Thank you, by Random House. I'm interested that you call people sister.
Yeah.
And when I talked to your publicist, they said to me, you must call her Miss Angelou.
Yeah.
And I find that unusual, I suppose, and different. And yet it's obviously very important to you.
Well, you see, there are a number of reasons. One, Black Americans truly are much more formal than they would have a lot of people know. The formality is, for the most part, an Africanism, which still has currency. It also was maintained through the horrors of the centuries of slavery, when Black people could be called anything by whites, and always by their first names. But even now, a black woman or man who will say, for instance, 70 years in these folks' world, the child I works for calls me girl. But when that woman goes into the church or to her neighborhood, people call her Sister Hudson, Mother Hudson, Auntie Hudson, Mrs. Hudson. Nobody would dare walk up to that woman and call her girl, unless it's one of her sister friends. And that then is when a black woman says to another black woman, girl, that establishes, it simply acknowledges the bond they have between themselves. But I have worked very hard, and I've lived a long time, and I am a formal person, and it pleases me to have something to offer a friend, or after knowing somebody for a while, to say, would you call me Maya? But if I allow the pretension of intimacy, then there is nothing. So in my classes, all over the country, wherever I teach, the dictate is everyone in my class is called by his or her last name, using any appellation thereto appertaining. Mm-hmm. So it's Ms. Jackson or Mr. Rakowski or whatever. Then I explain to students after that, they will not presume an intimacy. Hi, Karen. Hi, Jack. No. Hi, Miss So-and-so. Hi, Mr. So-and-so. After a while, they then say, listen, my name is Karen. and they have suddenly reached a higher plateau.
Do they have to earn it?
Yes, you earn you don't. I don't know about earning, but you grow into intimacy, not a presume it. It is dangerous to do it.
Well, it's interesting because the sister friend is such an intimate thing to call someone.
Yes.
And I contrast that to the Ms., the Miss, the Mister, which as you say is a very formal.
Yes. But you can still, I mean, it still says, it's a little like being an autobiographer. People assume that because I'm an autobiographer, I have written 5 books on my life, they assume they know me. They know what I have chosen to say. You see?
Yes.
I have tried to tell the truth, but I have not tried to tell everything I know. So when I say a sister friend, that never allows her beyond a certain place, nor would I dream of going beyond a certain place. That's what this book is about. I shall not be moved. Mm-hmm. It means that within every human being, there is a place which is inviolate, that every person, whether the ancestors came from Ireland in the 1840s trying to escape the potato blight, whether they came from Asia in the 1840s, unable legally to bring their mates for 7, 8, 9 decades, whether they came from Africa lying spoon fashion in the filthy hatches of slave ships, whether they came from Eastern Europe trying to escape the pogroms and arriving at Ellis Island having their names changed to something absolutely unpronounceable, they have already paid for everybody. So everyone has within himself, this place of morality from which he, she should never be persuaded or swayed. I shall not be moved from here. Well, once if young men and women knew that, if children knew that early on, if they were told, darling, within yourself you have a place so inviolate that no one, no mother, father, brother, no teacher, no boss has the right to invade, that's the place you will go when you reach for that last breath and can't get it and face your creator or whatever that is. That place should be pristine.
And yours.
In everybody.
I'm watching the clock here and I'm hoping to squeeze out one more question for you. But I know that there was a time in your young life when you didn't speak.
Yes.
a four-year period. Right. And I believe that you did read poetry and read a lot.
Yes.
What made you want to talk again?
Oh, a woman who knew I loved poetry just harassed me and needled me pushed me into reading aloud, into speaking. She told me I could never love poetry unless I felt it come across my tongue, through my teeth, over my lips. She said, you can't love poetry. It was such a terrible thing to me. I thought she was trying to take away my only friend. But she needled me. And finally, I tried to speak a poem, and I had voice.
Well, I guess it makes me think about the power of words. We use words so carelessly and so in such meaningless kinds of ways. But I guess to be drawn back to language through words that each word has been chosen, as you say, has been pulled out and put on a page.
But you see, in every biblical tome, in the Christian belief, in the Judeo-Christian religion, in the Bible, the Torah, in the Quran, in everything, Bhagavad Gita, there is the insistence of the importance of word. In the beginning was the word, and the word was God, and the word was with God. So words, we are not respectful enough of their power. We have no idea of their power.
Well, I thank you.
Thank you for your many words.
Thank you
for you asking me good questions and your own grace.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My guest has been writer Maya Angelou. Her books include I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings, The Heart of a Woman, and a new collection of poems titled I Shall Not Be Moved. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air